Wonderful to see you all. Hope everybody is doing well and that you had a wonderful week last week. Everybody, hopefully. I wanted to, first of all, thank everybody for coming. It's always great to see you all. I know it's hard. Someone recently asked me when I said I'm not available Sunday night for something. They said, Sunday night? I said, yeah, I have a class. They said, like what, 6:37? I said, no, 9 p.m. 9 p.m. Who has a class at 9 o'clock at night on a Sunday night? I said, I didn't choose it. These guys chose it. This is what we used to do back when. It's hard to believe. It's 28 years ago.
Wow.
We started this about 28 years ago. That's pretty amazing. I think it'll be 28 years this October or November. It'll be 28 years. Mm. Now, we won't count the fact that I left for a few years, but we can just say we started back in 1995. That's what we tell everybody. Woo. But it's pretty amazing. This was our slot. So it's pretty cool. Pretty cool. So it's great to see you all. Welcome to Ronnie. First time, I know, long time listener, first time caller. That's fine. Thank you. That's great.
Good to be here.
You've been here at least once before. So you get a semi welcome back. Right, Shelby, you've been here once before.
Yes.
Okay, there you go. All right, so let me ask you a very simple question, gentlemen. We're in the middle, as we know, we're counting the Omer, working our way up to the next holiday, the holiday of Shavuot. Okay, it's the day that we celebrate the giving of the Torah to the Jewish people, a landmark, perhaps the most historic event in world, certainly Jewish history, perhaps world history. But my question to you is, if you were going to decide where to give the Torah, where would you have chosen? Give me some place on earth where you would have given the Torah. Given the prominence that it plays, and it changed the course of history. Where would you have given it?
Jerusalem.
Okay. You would give it in Jerusalem. You're even more specific. I think we would all agree that the first choice would be to give it in the land of Israel. You're telling me, Steve, and I don't disagree, is that even within the land of Israel, I would have chosen the most prominent city, Jerusalem. Okay. I'm good with that. What other options, gentlemen?
Sinai.
You would have given it, Eddie, at Sinai.
Well, that's where the Ten Commandments
came. I know that's what actually happened, but if you were God, Eddie, where would you have chosen to give it?
I was thinking Mount Sinai.
You're so full of farping, Nugent. You would not have given it Mount Sinai.
What about Eden?
Please. Yeah. I mean, what can you name me any landmarks nearby that stand out to you?
What about Eden, Rabbi?
Given it in Eden. Well, you have to tell me where it is first.
Who knows?
Ah, that's a good question. I don't know where the Garden of Eden is. That's a good question.
That's where God says it is.
That's true. So I can't really expect that the historical event would take place in a place that we don't even know where it is.
It's mythical.
It's not mythical. It's a real place. It's a real place. You'll see it again in the right time. We'll see it again. I think, Eddie, seriously, to go back to your point, I think my question isn't so much where would you give it. I think the last place on earth you would have given it is in some barren, remote desert. Why would God have given us the Torah in a desert? There's nothing around. There's no prominence. There's no focus. There's no PR. There's nothing. It's out in no man's land. Why would God have chosen to do it specifically there in a wilderness? This is the overarching question, which I'm sure you have thoughts about. But I want to begin with the following, and I'm going to just throw it out there. Can someone share with me a highlight? Let's say over the last year, you experienced some wonderful event that you really got a high from, a real boost. And I'm not talking about artificially inspired. Give me some kind of some kind of experience. Maybe your child or grandchild graduated, or you married off somebody, or you had a child, or right? There are moments in our lives which we get a boost. We get a real high from the experience. Can someone share with me something that's happened recently in their life?
Yeah, Rabbi. It's Ronnie.
Go ahead.
Right, just before Pesach, from Newark, New Jersey, where my daughter lives in Inglewood, Newark Airport. I get off the plane. I go by the New York Post. I like to read their paper. There's a Jewish connection with the yarmulke. He said, "Are you Jewish?" "Yes." "You want to put up the tefillin?" "Sure." So I put up the tefillin in the New York Airport.
There you go.
That made me feel good.
Oh, nice.
Great. That's a great experience. A great experience. But now comes the harder question, Ronnie. When did that happen? That was right before Pesach?
The day before Pesach.
Okay, the day before Pesach. Be honest. You were on a high. It really was a great way to go into the holiday, correct?
Right.
You had a letdown since?
No.
Okay.
Really. Had a great Pesach with my daughter, son-in-law, my grandkids, Machatonim.
It was beautiful. Oh, there's your letdown right there. No, just kidding. Just kidding. I'm just kidding.
But I was so excited to put this phone on the airport, I forgot to pay the guy for the paper. I walked away and took the paper. It was $2, so I didn't pay for it.
It's funny because I think most of us, with various experiences that we have in life, we have these moments of high, a great experience, but it's often followed by somewhat of a letdown. There gets to be a point, maybe it's shortly thereafter. It's not very long. It could be a week. It could be a month. It could be even 3 months. But it's not 20 years later of where you have an up and then you have the experience of a down. Your highs and then lows. It is a pretty standard experience in life. We get
definitely. Could you mute everyone? Is there a way to do that?
Yes. Let's do that.
Hard to hear.
I just assumed it was me.
No, I think it's coming from Steven's phone.
Hold on. Why am I not seeing it? Here we go. Mute all. Okay. Obviously, if you want to speak, unmute yourself, please. Okay. That should hopefully be a little bit better. We experience in life our ups and our downs. We get these tremendous peaks, but then it comes crashing down soon thereafter. I'll give you an example. Right now, we're in the middle of counting the Sfira, counting the Omer between Pesach and Shavuot. We have the excitement of Pesach. It was a great uplifting experience in terms of our exodus, our freedom. And we're going to have, God willing, another great experience when there comes the holiday of Shavuot and that excitement building towards there. But at the same time, we're also in the midst of observing the days of mourning for the students of Rabbi Akiva that died. So it's, yay, I'm excited. But I'm also, there's periods of a letdown. And even in the midst of my letdown of where I do have these periods of mourning, of where I'm not shaving, there's no weddings. But then smack in the middle of it, you have Lag BaOmer. Oh, another high, another great celebration. It's up, it's down, it's up, it's down. And we continue to do that in life. The goal, obviously, is to learn to ride the wave. There are no such things. I shouldn't say it that way. It is extremely difficult not to get a high, but to maintain a high. All of you, I can't imagine any of you not having some interaction with the stock market, some more than others. But you all know with the stock market that it cannot be a gradual, continuous rise. It goes up and it will come down and it rises again and it will come down again. And it goes in that pattern. The goal, obviously, is that from your starting point to your ending point, you end up higher than you did when you started. That is the analogy of life. We have our ups, we have our downs, and they are inevitable. You can't escape them. It's a fact of life. We all experience it this way. I would say that an extreme example would be a question that they ask. We have this experience of receiving the Torah at Shavuot. We get the Torah. God, as Eddie correctly said, God speaks the Ten Commandments. He gives us the whole Torah. And yet, a mere 40 days later, we come crashing down and serve the golden calf. It's 40 days, gentlemen. I mean, it's like a nothing. It's a month and change. After witnessing, I know you guys hold on to the inspiration from this class for at least 6 months each class. I know, I get it. But seriously speaking, how can it be just 40 days after hearing God speak to the entire nation, they revel around and they're dancing and serving a calf, an idol? I don't have the answer, except it is a factual reality. You cannot remain on that high. It just can't be done. Let me put it differently, which I think we can relate to. How many of you have had this question before? Of where? I know I've been asked this question many times. Rabbi, how come God doesn't perform open miracles anymore? How come? You see, if God were to have a splitting of the sea nowadays, I think I'd be a much bigger believer. It's hard to believe. How do I know God even exists nowadays? God would only show us open miracles like he did in the old days. When you read the stories in the Torah, I'd have no trouble. I'd have no problem believing. I've been asked this question many times. My answer is based on a Nachmanides, on the Ramban. Nachmanides himself, he's one of the greatest leaders. He lived in the, I want to say 1200s, maybe 1300s, a little something around then. He addresses this question and he says very simply, yes, it's true. Open miracles give us a boost of faith in God. However, he says, they cannot keep you sustained. It does not have sustaining power. It's the everyday that is what keeps us going. An open miracle is a boost. That's all it is. It's a big, fat, I am here, signed God. But now it's the day-to-day activities of recognizing the small things in life that we recognize God that keeps it going. I truly believe this, that even if there were these open miracles that made it so crystal clear that Hashem is God in this world, yes, I'd get a few more people coming to the classes, but I don't know if it will sustain them. There has to be the day-to-day. The Jewish people experienced at Mount Sinai the giving of the Torah, the revelation of God speaking to an entire nation, contrary to the movie where God only spoke to Moses. That's not true. The Torah's version has it that God spoke to all of us. And when he spoke to us, it was like nothing we can imagine. It was a boost of belief in a God. And then only 40 days later, it was lost. Because that is the reality. We face in life these ups and these downs. The verse in Tehillim, in Psalms, King David says very beautifully, Miyale Bahar Hashem, who will merit to go up, so to say, the mountain of God? Umi Yakum Bimkom Kachai, and who will stand in his holy place? The simple meaning is, who will have the opportunity to merit to go into the temple, to ascend the mountain of God, and to remain there, and to get some level of sanctity from the experience. However, our sages point out that the deeper meaning of that verse is that there's two parts. Who actually will even merit to go up? Who will get an inspiration when they encounter God on the mountain? That's one level. But what's even harder is who can sustain that? Who can hold on to that inspiration and keep it going beyond just being there? What is an unknown or not well-known law? And that is when you enter into the temple itself. I'm not talking about our shuls. I'm talking about the temple in Jerusalem. If you entered from one entranceway on one side of the temple, you were obligated. Let's say you came in on the north side. When you left the temple, you were supposed to leave on the southern side and vice versa. The verse says, do not exit the way you entered. Strange, interesting law. Why can't I go out the same way? It's the closest to my house. I need to catch the bus, catch the train, light rail, whatever you're going to take to get to Jerusalem, right? To get to the temple. If you went in one door, you don't come out the same door. Why? What would possibly be the reason for that law? Feel free to unmute.
Because you're changed after you get
a call. That's exactly right. Because if you go in one way, you entered the temple and you came out the same as you went in, you missed the whole point of going. If you go through a high holiday season and you haven't been budged one iota, then you missed it. It can't be. You have to be able to walk away with something that you take with you. It's concretized into something real. Make it a small thing. But you cannot exit the same way that you entered. You can't be the same person. Something must have changed. Our sages teach us about this concept of when we go through our ups and our downs. For the rest of this class, I want to use the word transition. When we transition from one experience to another, from a high to a low or from a low to a high, any kind of transition, what we're doing is we're crossing over and we're passing through a natural cycle. It's not out of the norm. Psychology today has understood this finally. I don't know about you guys, but I certainly remember growing up that when people experienced highs and lows, we immediately thought something was not normal. Well, how can it be? You know, I'll give a bad example. It's a terrible example, and I hope God forbid, nobody we know has experienced it, but it's pretty common. Postpartum depression. After a lady has a baby, it's an extremely high experience to birth a child into this world. It's an amazing thing. And yet, in a relatively short period of time, many women have difficulty and trouble, and it's some level of depression. It's not a fault. It's not something necessarily abnormal. It is a function of life. Highs bring lows. The case, the medical condition in dealing with postpartum depression is because it got to a point perhaps of where intervention is now necessary. The person needs some kind of help and strategy on how to deal with it. But it is not abnormal. It is normal to have the lows after the highs when you have transitions. We are called Ivrim, right? Hebrew language is called Ivrit. We've talked about this. But the word, interestingly enough, in Hebrew for transition is ma'aver or ma'avar. Mem, ayin, bet, resh. The same Hebrew word as Ivri or Ivrit. It's the same word. It means to pass through, to cross over. We are the people who understand that we are always in transition, moving from point A to point B. We're always crossing over and passing through to the next level. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down, but we do not remain stagnant. It's an important idea. We don't remain stagnant. If you ever watch a bird in flight is a great example. Birds flap their wings in order to reach certain points of elevation. They reach a certain height. And then what? They'll stop flapping their wings and they'll coast. They'll coast for a little while. But if they do not flap their wings again, by definition, they begin to descend. You cannot remain on that level without putting in an effort. We are the people. We are Ivrim. The people who are always in motion. I don't know. Maybe we are the source of ADHD. We're always moving, constant motion. We don't sit still for 1 second. It's not a bad thing. If you really take the time to think about this concept of transitions, here's a fascinating point. I throw this out there for you, and I would love to hear your feedback. The majority of the five books of the Torah, the five books of Moses. So the first book, known as Bereshit Genesis, is the story of our history. That's really the basics. It takes it from Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden, the beginning of time, and it takes us till the Jews are basically enslaved at the end of the Joseph era in Egypt. That's book one. Book two begins with the servitude, the slavery in Egypt, working our way through the Exodus. And now, after we leave and the splitting of the sea and even receiving the Torah, we stand at Mount Sinai, we get the Torah, and then begins the construction of the tabernacle, and that's done. That's the end of book two. Beginning of book three starts the stories of what's done in the tabernacle, what's done in the temple with the offering, the sacrifices, fine. Halfway through that book, till the end of the book, is nothing but what? Anybody, tell me if in your own words, what do you think comprised the last 2.5 books of the Torah? Come on, you know it, guys.
Laws.
Yeah.
There are laws. What else?
The Mishkan.
Well, the Mishkan that's done already. That's done at the end of book two.
Rules.
Yes, we got laws and rules. But something, go ahead, Jeff, you were going to say it.
No, I was going to say what Brad said, the laws.
There's more than that. There's a boatload of stories, but they all have one common theme. What is it?
Ups and downs.
Well, it's more than ups and downs. It's a heck of a lot of complaints. It's troubles, complaints, missteps, anger issues. I mean, rebellion. It's a whole book, 2.5 books worth of recounting all of the missteps that the Jewish people have from the time we leave Egypt until we enter the land of Israel. How many years in total is that, by the way, from when we leave until we enter the land of Israel?
You mean left Egypt?
From when we left Egypt to when we came into Israel.
Just under 40, about 38.
40 years. That's exactly right. It's 40 years. 40 years. Okay. So if I'm going to ask you these questions, we have story after story. We have the story of the spies. We have the story of Korach's rebellion. We have stories of they lacked water and they complained to Moshe. And you have the stories of they argue and they want meat, and the story of the quail. It goes on and on and on and on, story after story of troubles and missteps. In the course of those 40 years, Irving, tell me, approximately, how does it shake out over the course of the, would you say like on average every couple of years was another story?
Well, yeah, we were refining ourselves.
Right. I also thought that over the course of those 40 years, in year one, we had this trouble, and then we learned from that mistake, and we went on a little bit further in the desert, and then we had another misstep, and then another trouble, and then another rebellion. And over the course of those 40 years, okay, this is recounting all the stories. But Irving, you'd be as wrong as I was.
All sounds like a lot of kvetching.
A lot of kvetching. Eddie, I say it all the time. The one who wrote this Torah, the one who wrote this book, it's either God or an anti-Semite, because we do nothing right. It's all what we do wrong.
Well, the spies.
Yeah.
That was a mistake.
There were a lot of mistakes that we made. I'm not saying it's not correct. But that was
10, but 2 were right. So that was a split decision.
I wouldn't call that a split decision. The Jewish people sided with the 10, and they basically silenced the 2. So, right. Now, yeah, I mean, it may have been a 10-2 decision on the judicial level, but as far as what the people bought into, it was a slam dunk. You sided with the 10. They all cried. what was fascinating for me to learn is that almost all of the stories, in fact, all the stories take place either in year 1/2, meaning the first year and a half from when we left Egypt, or the very last year, year number 40. 38 years in the middle, nothing goes wrong. Most people do not know this. All these stories that we read in the Torah, what happened in the wilderness, what happened in the desert, and this trouble and that trouble, it was either year 1 or 2 or year 40. Steve, case in point, is the spies was year 1. It was right away. How do I know that? Because God actually says after the story of the spies, he's so upset that he says, for each day that you spied out the land, you're going to be punished with a year of wandering. 40 days they spied out the land, hence 40 years. That's how I know it's in year 1 of the Exodus. It either takes place in year 1 or 2 or year 40. That means everything went great for 38 years. Why is it that we had it all great? And we only misbehaved, we acted out in the beginning or the end. Those are the only two times that we acted out. Nothing in the middle went wrong. This is a question that the great, the Alter from Slabodka, Reb Simcha Zissel said, asked this question. And the Alter gives the following answer, exactly what we're talking about tonight. It is human nature that when we go through periods of transition, when we are going from one stage to another, there is tremendous upheaval in our lives. It is stressful. It puts us on edge, and often we make mistakes. It is human nature that when we go through transitional periods, we make mistakes because our minds are so busy trying to deal with the situation of transition that we aren't thinking 100% clearly. How many of us have raised teenagers? Yes, teenagers. Teenagers are the most tumultuous years in a child's upbringing, in a child's growing up. Why? Because it is the most traumatic change in terms of transitioning from a child to an adult. It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen even over a few years. It takes multiple years. I'll show you just how this is reflected. Listen to this. Jordy, I'm going to put you on the spot here. When a child becomes bar mitzvah, bar or bat mitzvah, we say that they become responsible in the performance of all mitzvos, right? They now are considered adults, correct?
Correct.
However, tell me, Jordy, tell me, please, what is the law regarding, let's say, a 14 or 15-year-old boy or girl who goes ahead and violates a certain Torah, a certain mitzvah in the Torah, whose punishment is only that which is done within heaven. It's not a court kind of case. It's not something that can be punishable in the Jewish court. God takes care of it. It's known as, let's say, a punishment bidei shamayim, in the hands of heaven. 15-year-old.
I assume he gets a pass. He gets a pass?
Yes, he does. He or she gets a pass. Until what age?
20.
That is correct, Jeff. Thanks for bailing Jordan out.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut him off.
I did not know the answer, so thank
you. It's a fascinating law. That means on the one hand, the 13-year-old is really responsible, but he or she is not totally responsible until age 20. Why? Because it reflects a truth that the child between ages of 13 and 20 is in the process. It is transitioning to becoming a full-fledged adult. Now, I had a teacher in high school who said to us that everybody matures at some point. Everybody matures. And then he paused and he said, yes, unfortunately, some people peak very early. Everybody matures, but the ages between 13 and 20 is a time of unbelievable transition for a person. Their development of moving from a child who is 100% dependent to becoming an independent adult is a transition that doesn't fully happen until age 20. Therefore, it is the most tumultuous years in a child's development because of this idea. If you're transitioning between stages, it is more stressful. It is more, it lacks a certain level of serenity and tranquility because you're in transition. Therefore, we are more vulnerable to making silly judgments. That is a teenager. They make these quick snap decisions because they are not fully developed yet. They're in the middle of a transition. Okay. Perhaps that's the reason why we sinned with the golden calf. Yes, it's true. We did experience this most amazing revelation from God, but it doesn't happen on a dime. We can't change that quickly. There's a level of transition. So when we first left Egypt and we experienced moving from slavery to freedom, that's a major transition. It was only 7 weeks from the time we left until we got the Torah at Mount Sinai. That's not a very long time. And even 40 days more, it takes time. And even after the golden calf, we still weren't finished. We were in the midst of transitioning. After 2 years, approximately, okay, we got into a rhythm. There were things that we still needed to learn. Irv, you're right. There were things we needed the full 40 years to get into it. But we got into a routine. We got into a groove. We were growing as a people. We were learning what it meant to be a Jewish people with a Torah, preparing to go into the land of Israel. Now you fast forward 38 years, and we're on the cusp of actually entering. Uh-oh, here we go again. It's transition time. We're going to have to move away from the miraculous living of manna falling from the sky as our sustenance, the well of Miriam providing water in a desert, the clouds of all of this is going to change once we go in. It's transition time again. Hence, in the last year, again, we run into trouble. Even when we talked about the stages of birth, the stage is actually called transition. It may be the shortest, but it's the most intense right before the baby is born. It's called transition. And what's amazing is that the women, and again, this is a credit to them, their ability to go through that to the best of their ability, but what you will hear sometimes from women at that time, and they say, I can't do this. I give up. I can't do it. I vividly remember my wife saying that. Obviously, she didn't mean it, but it's a difficult period. The words, I can't do it. Think of a transition in your own life when you transition to a different job or you transitioned into a new stage of life with children, let's say, or whatever, any kind of transition. You get to a point of where you're not sure you can do it. You question it and you say, I can't do this. It's hard. Yeah, it is. And your feelings of despair are not abnormal. I want to give you another idea about this. And so you'll appreciate just the depth of this. We've spoken in the past why we're called Yehudim. Yehudim is Jews. Why are we called Yehudim? So the classic answer that's given comes from the word Hodah, which means to give thanks. We're a people that always appreciate or should appreciate all the gifts that we have in our life. That's one answer, and we've spoken about that. But I want to share with you a second answer. Maybe I don't think I've shared this with you in the past. To appreciate this, we have to go through a story in the Torah that we're all familiar with. It's the climax of the story of Joseph revealing himself to his brothers. Let's just recap very briefly. Joseph is sold as a slave by his brothers. They decide not to kill him. And he gets sold and he gets taken down to Egypt. And he works for a man named Potiphar. And he runs the household. He's quite good at it. And then ultimately, Mrs. Potiphar decides that she has strong emotional feelings for Yosef. And she basically propositions him. He doesn't want a part of it. She grabs his garment. It tears as he runs out of the house. And she claims that he raped her. And she was able to grab a piece of his clothing as he was leaving. He was thrown in jail. And he languishes in prison for 12 years. Fast forward, Pharaoh has his dream. He's taken out. He interprets the dream. He becomes second in command. There's a famine throughout the region. Joseph's brothers come down. They need to collect food and they come before Joseph. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. They beg for food. He decides he'll give them. He gives them he puts them through a whole cross-examination. Who are you? How many kids are you? What happened? And they tell him the life story. And he says, I'll give you food, but don't come back down here unless you bring your youngest son, who you had told me about, Benjamin, until you bring him here. So fine, they go back to where they live with Jacob. And after a period of time, they're out of food again and they need to come back. And they say, we can't come before Joseph without bringing Benjamin. Jacob wants no part of this because he already figures he lost one of his sons from Rachel, meaning Joseph. He doesn't want to lose the only other one from Rachel, Benjamin. But Yehuda says, I take full responsibility. Fine. Yaakov agrees. They come down and they go through this whole process. And he gives them food. He recognizes this is Binyamin, gives them food, but he purposely plants Benjamin's sack, his goblet, Joseph's goblet. Sure enough, they leave. He sends the guards after them and claiming that they stole the golden chalice from the palace. You like that? And they went ahead and they took it. Fine, they bring him back and he wants to keep Benjamin in prison. This is the part I want you to focus on. Joseph says, let the guilty party be imprisoned. And now Yehuda steps up to the plate. Judah, not the oldest. He's child number four. Yehuda steps up and gives Yosef a whole song and dance. No, I will take his place. I'm the one. You can't let Benjamin stay here because it's going to have such a detrimental effect on his father. I will stay, but no, I will not give up. At that point, Joseph sees that he's willing to stand up for his brother, which is somewhat rectifying the mistake that he hadn't done when it was Joseph on the line. He reveals himself, and that's pretty much the end of the story. I read not that long ago that we are called Yehudim, Jews, because of the actions of Yehuda. This action of Yehuda, where everybody is in the room, all 12 boys are there. They're all there. And everybody is paralyzed because they found the goblet in Benjamin's sack. And Joseph rightfully has the right to say he's the one who's going to be in prison. And nobody was able to do anything. They all were like, he's right. We have no legal grounds to argue. We have not. They were paralyzed. Nobody said boo. They despaired of the situation. Except for one guy, Yehuda. Judah says, I know the odds are against me. The odds are against all of us here. Benjamin is the guilty party. I have no way of proving that it was a setup. He was framed. But he's not willing to accept the desperate situation. He does not despair. And he's willing to fight whatever it takes to win. We are called Yehudim. Because we follow in the footsteps of Judah. We never despair. We never say, I can't. We can't. We all live, thank God, at a time where we have a state of Israel. Thank God we celebrated 75 years. It's a miracle. If you ever want to get into a conversation, God doesn't perform open miracles. Yeah, just look at the state of Israel. It's an open miracle. The fact that we have it, and thank God we still have it. If we're up to everybody else in the world, we would all be living in the Mediterranean Sea underwater. The point is very simple, and that is we do not accept despair. There is no word in the Torah. File this in your trivia books. There's no Hebrew word in the Torah for the word despair and give up. It doesn't exist anywhere in the five books of the Torah because it's not a Torah mentality. We do not. Yes, there are highs and there are lows, and we come crashing down with lows. That is a normal process of life, but we do not throw up our hands and say, I give up. I can't. We can't. It does not exist. The entire origin of our people is two people who were old, Abraham and Sarah, 100 years old, 90 years old. Okay, you want to account for the fact that they lived longer? Fine. Do the extrapolation. Abraham died at 175. So he's at least 50, 45, 50 years old. He hasn't had kids in ever. Sarah didn't have any children. Okay, Abraham had Yishmael 13 years earlier, but they're old, 190. He's 100, she's 90. The origin of our people defy the odds. We shouldn't be around, but we don't despair. Despair is not a Jewish word. It is the ploy of the Yetzer Hara. It is the ploy of our evil inclination for us to say, I can't. I can't do it. It's out of my realm. It's out of my abilities. No. I once had a teacher who said to us that if that feeling of despair overcomes you and you get that, I can't do it. I can't do it. I've been beat down so long. He says, you should look at it in the opposite perspective. He told us that it's a great sign. He says, why? That's not a good sign. He says, no, it is. Because that means the Yetzer Hara knows that you have that potential to do it. And he's fighting you tooth and nail that you don't accomplish it. But that means you could. The more that there's a tension, that struggle, the more you'll grow from it. And you can overcome it. It's a sign of how good you could be. And he wants to stop us. That's why there's this fight. We have to look at all of these transitional periods as it is a normal process, but we have the capability of overcoming and capitalizing on it. So let me do this. Are we good on this so far? Any questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Rabbi? Yes, please, Brad.
Wasn't the Israelites that went into Israel, the Bnei Israel that went into the land was not the same generation as the Israelites that received the Torah, right?
The vast majority of them did die out in the desert. That is true.
40 years.
That is true. Over the course of those 40 years, that's true. There were a handful of exceptions, but those kids under 20 went in. They were okay. And I don't know, but my heart tells me that even those who are older in the 60s made it in also. Could be that they died out naturally. But it doesn't say that explicitly. But certainly the under 20 population absolutely went in. That is true. So how can we view transitions properly? So this is very cool, guys. You'll love this. The Hebrew alphabet has 22 letters, 22 primary letters, right? Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, so on. First letter is Aleph. Last letter is Tav. Aleph to Tav, A to Z. What's the middle letter? What's right in the middle? You can use your toes if you need to.
Lamed.
Close. You're very close, Steve.
Mem.
Mem. Yeah, Mem. Mem is the middle letter. So it's interesting. The letter Mem, is often used when it relates, especially when you hear the word Mem, it reminds you of the word Mayim. Mayim is what? Water. Water is the primary element that's used when there's a transition period. We're going to explain that in a minute. But look at the word itself. Aleph being the first letter, Mem the middle letter, and Tav the last letter. Aleph, Mem, Tav spells the word Emet. Emet. Emet means truth. In fact, it's the sign of God. Aleph, Mem, Tav. The first letter is the beginning. Last letter is the end. Mem is the middle, the transitional letter. Here's what's cool. Take those three letters, Aleph, Mem, and Tav. If you put Aleph and Mem together, it spells the word aim. Aim is? What's mother. Aim? Like Ima. Aim is mother. Aim is mother, Av is father. So Aleph, Mem, aim is mother. That's the beginning of a person's life. Take the Mem and the Tav together. Take the last two letters of this word. Mem and Tav spell mate. Mate is death. Yes. So the word Emet, which is the signature of God, the beginning, if you take Aleph and Mem together, spells the beginning of man, mother. The last, if you take the middle and last letter, mate, spells death. Because Mem, which is on both sides of it, is the transition letter. In Kabbalah, they talk about this. Mem being the letter of transition, of helping people transition from one stage to another. Even you can look at it this way. Aleph represents the past, which you can't change. Tav represents the future, which again is out of our realm of what we can do. We can go towards the future, but you can't touch it. Mem is the transition. It's the arena of action of the present. Mem is the here and now. Do you follow that? In that word, emet, Aleph, Mem, Tav, right? Aleph and Mem together spell aim, mom. Mem, Tav, the last two letters spell death, beginning and end. The transitional letter is the letter Mem. When you think of water in a religious context, what comes to mind? Where is water used?
Mikvah.
In a mikvah. A mikvah. A mikvah is a ritual bath. What happens in a mikvah? Let's say you buy new dishes. You buy new dishes. So the halacha is, the law is, that you're supposed to immerse them in a mikvah. Somebody who converts to Judaism has to go to a mikvah. A woman, after she finishes her monthly cycle, she goes to the mikvah. What do they all have in common?
The woman, breaks her water when she's giving birth.
Okay, that's also true. But what do they all have in common? The idea of converting to Judaism, of when you get new dishes and you want to, quote unquote, make them kosher, or when the woman has her cycle, what do they all have in mind, have in common?
Transition. Europe.
It's transition. It's moving from one stage to another. The dishes that were manufactured by a non-Jewish company, I want to dedicate them for my kosher food. I immerse them in a mikvah. A woman who has her cycle, where the opportunity now to create life is again, she transitions from having lost the egg, having where she shed that lining, and now she's transitioning back to the opportunity to create life again. Or someone who converts to Judaism, there's a change in status. There's a transition, usually an upward transition. It's always associated with mem, mayim, water, a mikvah. This is perhaps the reason why, going back to our original question, I had asked you, why of all places on earth does God decide to give us a Torah in a wilderness, in a barren desert, nothing around? The answer is, add one more piece to really appreciate it. There was a French ethnographer, I can't even pronounce his name. He wrote something about the levels of what's known as a rites of passage. His name was Arnold Van Gennep, I think. I found this in Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, Lord Sachs, the one who passed away not that long ago, in one of his articles. What a great insight he brings. He says there's basically, this Arnold Van Gennep says there's three stages whenever there's a rite of passage. The first thing is separation, of where you have to break with your past. If you want to move to another level, the first thing you have to do is to break free from what has held you till now. You have to break free, separate from the past. Skip the second part for a second. The third part is the actual incorporation, the re-entry with your new identity or your new education. You have to break what was, and then ultimately you have to re-enter as the new you with the new entity. What's in the middle? The transition, that's between who you were and who you're about to become. You're recast, reborn, reshaped, refashioned. Every rite of passage has to go through all three stages. Break from where you were, become that middle ground. Somewhere in the middle, you're not where you were, but you're not where you want to be yet. That's the transition. And then ultimately you enter with the new identity. This is his concept. Rabbi Sacks suggests that is the reason why the Torah had to be given to us in the midst of our transition, after we left Egypt, but before we entered the land of Israel. We were in a transitional period and we were transforming ourselves. We broke away from the past. We were no longer enslaved in Egypt. The slave mentality had to be broken, step number one. Ultimately, stage number three is that we re-entered as a new formed entity known as the Jewish people, living in the land of Israel with a Torah. The middle was that transitional period of where we weren't where we were, and we're not where we need to be yet. That's why it had to be there. He says the word liminal, that's the word that's used, is a Latin word, and it comes from threshold, of where you're crossing the threshold. You are transitioning. Every time you walk through a doorway, you cross a threshold because you transition from room A to room B, or from inside to outside, or vice versa. The Torah had to be given in no man's land in between shedding our slave mentality, but before completely becoming the nation that was going to become the standard for the world, the light unto the nations. The wilderness is not just a place, it's a state of being. I'm not there and I'm not there. I'm in between. The Torah is the mechanism that allows us to transition. This was his understanding. I thought it was such an incredible insight about how to understand everything we go through in life at all the different stages. Whenever we go through a transition in life, and the truth is, it doesn't only have to be big transitions. It's pretty much regular. We're always transitioning. Like I said, we're always moving, hopefully in the upward direction, but we're never stagnant. So we're always transitioning. What the Torah is teaching us, and perhaps this is the lesson we can take from the transition period we're in now, from Pesach to Shavuos, where we're transitioning from the complete servitude of Egypt to becoming free people to get a Torah. We are transitioning. This is what we need to remember, that life is full of these transitions. It's inevitable. We're going to have some down moments. It's not a terrible thing. Don't despair. Don't give up. We never use that term. To know that all it is that we're in a critical middle stage. We're not where we were. We're breaking free from that. Here we go. A lobster. I know, very non-kosher example, but stick with me here. The lobster, you know what it has to do when it's growing? It has to get rid of its shell. It has to get rid of its shell, and it goes hiding under a rock until it's able to grow the next one. For it to reach the next level, it has to shed its previous one. It has to. That's what we go through. We go through our transitional period. We were who we were, but today I'm different. Is it the most comfortable? Maybe not, but I'm not where I want to be yet. I'm in transition. Life has that. to know that we're in those critical stages of the middle point of growth, to become the better, to become the more improved you with each day. This, I think, and I'll just end with this. This, I think, is really the message that's being taught to us. When we're working our way to getting a Torah on Shavuos, this is what we need to keep in mind. We are in transition. Transitions can be difficult, but ultimately, they're a critical stage for us to reach the goals that we want. That's what we have to keep in mind. Thought to ponder and to discuss amongst your friends. What do you think?
Yeah.
I don't want your opinion. Come on, give me something. Work with me. Ask me a question. Prove me wrong. Prove me right. What do you think, Jeff?
So this is, can you, I don't know if I'm on mute or not, but no, this is like, okay, this is off topic, but it's not a lot because it was like something that the ups and downs when you were talking about earlier. But I heard or read once that, like, once God sentenced everybody from like 20 to 60 to death because of the spy situation, that on Tisha B'Av was like the day that of reckoning for everybody, and like everybody would dig their own graves, and you never knew who was going to wake up in the morning, which is why on like they didn't know they got mixed up when Tisha B'Av was the last time and they lived. But so is that the case? Is that what we? I mean, that would be horrifying every year to like. You go through the year, and then, you know, Tisha, here comes Tisha B'Av. We got to dig our own graves again. How? Well, I mean, that would be unbelievable.
Yes, I agree with you. It must have been an extremely difficult and challenging situation.
What a day.
Let me ask you a silly question, Jeff. Shouldn't that be the right perspective we should have going into Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur every year? Shouldn't
Good point.
That really be the way it is instead of hitting ourselves and saying, yeah, I know my life's on the line, but all right, you know, I do have plans that, you know, that in 2026, I'm hoping to go with the family. I mean, that's not taking it so seriously. If we're making plans for 2026, then we're not digging our own graves and thinking this might be it. I think that's a tremendous lesson we should learn from them.
That's a really good point.
I mean, it's for them, it was real. It wasn't just lip service that, oh, yes, I'm being judged. And, you know, I assume it'll be somebody else. You know, I don't assume it'll be me, but they took it very seriously. And they're like, why do I have any right to assume me over someone else? I know this is going to happen. Who says that we're not going to be in that group this year? I mean, God willing, we won't, but who says? It was real. That's the way we should walk into Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I think I told you, I don't remember, I teach this story. Did I tell you the story about the Magid, the preacher who went from town to town? Did I say that last week? No? This guy, in the old days, they used to have what was known as a Magid. He was a preacher. He would come every year to different towns. And he would speak to the rabbis and the leaders of the community to get a sense of what's lacking in each community. And he would try to give them an inspirational, usually a fire and brimstone kind of talk about getting them on track. He comes to a particular community and he's told that there's a general lax of observance and people aren't taking mitzvot at all seriously. So he gets up and he tries to encourage them about the beauty of mitzvos and encouraging them to perform and observe it. And he says to them the following. He says, let me tell you a story about a gentleman who he passed away and he comes before heaven and he meets God face to face. And God says to him, what do I do with you? You have exactly 50-50. You're on the line. You have the exact same number of mitzvot merits as you have demerits. You're right on the line. What should I do? To just let you go into heaven, I can't do that. And to put you down into purgatory, I can't do that either. You're right on the line. Here's what I'll do, God says. I'll let you go back down for 30 more minutes. 30 minutes. Go back down to earth. Let's see what you do in those 30 minutes. And let's see what your numbers will be when you come back. So sure enough, poof. He sends him down. Again, the preacher's telling the story. Sends him down for 30 minutes. And of course, you can imagine, this guy, he's going to run to go learn Torah. And this one, if it were him, he would run and he would give tzedakah. And this one, he would go daven. And this one, he would go help an old lady. He would utilize those 30 minutes to the max. And then hopefully he comes before heaven and it'll be more merits than demerits. The preacher looks at the crowd and he says, so if we have more than 30 minutes, why don't we use it properly? Why? Just because we see the preciousness of time. 30 minutes, let's accomplish. You have more than 30 minutes, so do more. So he pauses and then he slams the bima. He slams it down and he says, and who told you you even have 30 minutes? We don't know. We don't know.
So do it now.
That's how we have to look at it. We got to look at it and say, this is, I don't know what God has in store for me next year. I daven that I be in the right group. But those guys in the desert, they had no choice. It was real. That's the way we have to look at it. The time that we have is precious. Utilize it. Capitalize on it. What were you going to say, Brad?
Oh, no, I was just thinking about the Israelites again at the mountain or at the Egel. Isn't there commentary that the Israelites were actually just so high on God, they just made an Egel? I mean, they weren't like idol worshiping.
Well, then why did God get so upset and he killed 3,000 of us?
I don't know. I've just heard that maybe that was part of their high. They were just like really into God.
Well, that's a funny way of showing it, by making an idol where he just said, don't make idols.
Well, they're... Yeah, it was a wrong decision.
I don't know. I'm certainly not proficient in all the commentaries, but it seems
to me. You heard that.
I never heard that before, and it doesn't sit nicely with me because clearly it was a wrong decision. It was not the right thing to do. Now, you're right. I think part of what you're saying is that the majority of the Jewish people didn't substitute the golden calf for God. They substituted the golden calf for Moses. There's a difference there. It's still wrong. They still felt. I mean, if you want, we can talk about that. The Jewish people, when they sinned with the golden calf, it's everybody except the women. The women did not dance around. They did not serve that calf. Nor did Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi. Anyone who's a Kohen or a Levi today, you get an exemption. You're off the hook. That includes you, Brad. Okay? So you guys didn't do it. Maybe that's why you're so harsh on the rest of us. Because you didn't do it, right? But that means to say, though, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people did serve it, right? So my question to you, Brad, is why did only, and I put that in quotes, why only 3,000 Jews died? It should have been 30,000, 300,000. There were 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60 at that census.
But then
the vast majority all served the idols. So why only 3,000 died? It's a great question. You like it, huh?
Extreme ego worshipers.
You're right that you're saying it, but you're right. Because there's a difference. The majority of the Jewish people were not serving the idol, the egel, the golden calf, as if it were God. They were saying, oh no. What prompted all of this? The fact that according to their calculation, Moses was late in coming back. Moses was told them that he's coming down after 40 days and 40 nights. And they started counting the 40 days from when he went up the mountain. Moses meant to tell them that it surely shouldn't start until it's a full 24-hour period. The day he went up didn't count. So he was, quote unquote, one day late in their minds. When he didn't show up at the end of day 40, according to their calculation, they flipped out. And they said, we can't have a direct relationship with God. We need some intermediary. Moshe's always been our guy. Oy vey, oy vey, oy vey. So they built this golden calf, not to replace God, but to replace Moses. And God is still very upset because God has told us many times, do not believe in any intermediaries. You are welcome and encouraged. And I'm telling you, you can have a direct relationship with me. No intermediaries. This is why Jews hate to pay retail. Because we don't like paying a middleman. don't believe in middlemen. We go straight to the owner. That's what we do. But that's the reason. So therefore, so you say to me, what about those 3,000? So if you read the Torah carefully, the Torah says that there was a group that said, Elo Elohecha, when the eagle, when the golden calf was there, they said, Ela Elohecha Yisrael. This is your God, Israel. This is your God? What do you mean your God? It should say, this is our God. What do you mean your God? So Rashi and many other commentaries quote from early sources saying that it's that group of Egyptians that converted right before they left Egypt, the Erev Rav, known as the mixed multitude. They were always a thorn on the side. They're the ones who said, this is really your... They took the whole idolatrous culture out of Egypt. And they were saying, this is your God, Israel. Those are the 3,000 that died. They were replacing God. That's idol worship 101. But the 600,000 or whatever, you know, that served the idol wasn't as a replacement for God. It was a replacement for Moshe, which was wrong. And God is angry and wants to wipe us out for that. But please understand, there's a world of difference there. So yeah, if God is not happy with that behavior, I find it difficult to think that they were so high on God that they did exactly the opposite of what God asked them to do. That's hard. I find that difficult. But it could be. Like I said, I haven't read all the commentaries.
Peer pressure.
It was.
They had peer pressure.
Well, I'm sure there was a level of peer pressure. Once there's a mob mentality, they all panic.
Right. They all panic. Right.
Moshe tells them such a profound thing. Moshe says to them, if God spoke to you and God is offering you the Torah, that means you have the ability to have that relationship. Why would you squander it and think you need somebody in the middle? I'm just a messenger, Moshe keeps telling them. You have an issue, you have a complaint, you want water? Don't complain to me. Complain to the owner. Go straight to God. I'm not an intermediary. This is where we differ from Christianity. Christianity says you cannot have a relationship directly with God. You can only have it through Jesus. That's the only way. Without him, you have nothing. Judaism says that is as false can be. It's the exact opposite. The minute you put your faith in anything or anyone other than God, you are violating one of the most principles, the most basic principles of Judaism. It is us and him, nothing in the middle. Anything else? This is good. This is good stuff, man. Yeah, I won't be able to sleep tonight. I'm stoked.
In transition.
Yeah. Hey. Keep transitioning.
On the subject of transition, I've just gone through one 3 weeks ago. I gave notice to my former employer, and tomorrow I start with a new one.
And there you go.
So, Rabbi, is there a special bracha you could give me to give me a Zuchus for tomorrow?
I wish you, obviously, I would say that you have that power more than I do, that because it's coming from the depth of your heart, because you know that it's a difficult change. All change is difficult. Transitions are tough. So when you dive into Hashem, before you go to sleep tonight, whether you dive in Ma'ariv or not, take a minute and in your own words, say, Hashem, I start a new job tomorrow. I ask that you grace me with extra bracha, with mazel, that I be successful in my job, and that I can do what I know that I have the potential to do, but I know that I can count on you. Hashem, I ask for your help. That's how you daven. You say it in English, you say it in your own, it doesn't make a difference. The point is that it comes from within you, a sincere request from Hashem. My bracha is that Hashem grant you that wish. Hashem should give you all that you need, both the wisdom and the health and the abilities to accomplish what it is you set out to do. That's my bracha. Hashem should grant you that.
Thank you.
Fabulous. All right, gentlemen, a pleasure to see you. No class next week, but we hopefully will meet again on the 14th, right? May 14th.
Right.
Hopefully one more class, one, maybe two, before we break for the summer. Hold on 1 second. Let's just take a quick look here. I'm going to turn off the recording.